cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
This story, by the way, Katie, comes from Bloomberg Businessweek. It's found on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. It's about how the work from home revolution, initially we thought it would be a big step to women might finally be having it all. But as Bloomberg Businessweek contributor Ann Peterson writes, it has also become a trap for women. So let's see what she has to say. She joins us from Lummi Island, Washington. Hey, Ann, good to have you here with Katie and myself. So it was, I feel like this was expected to be the great leveler, if you will, and it hasn't necessarily, working from home, played out like we thought for women.
You know, it's hard because I think, like, before the pandemic, if you would say to moms in particular and heterosexual families, if you would say, hey, what if you could do your job from home and you could be there for pickup and to facilitate a bunch of other stuff and you could figure out where work would fit in your own life? And you wouldn't have to commute, and you wouldn't have to necessarily, like, spend all the time putting on work clothes every day. Like, would you choose that? Right?
Yes.
And I think a lot of people said, yes, I would choose that. It would make my life a lot easier. And what we've seen, which is not surprising given the state of different supports in the United States in particular right now, is that instead a lot of women who have flexible work options have become a sort of one-woman safety net. So they are providing the sort of support and care that maybe they split more equally with their husbands, maybe the school district provided a bit more of, or maybe even just like child care infrastructure provided more of.
And so there's so many different sort of combinations that flexible work as a woman could take. And it's a beautifully reported piece. You say that you've conducted hundreds of interviews with women over the past 2 years. So, I mean, sort of walk us through the common denominator, because you can't paint a flexible work arrangement with the same brush. I mean, some people might have some children in different stages of life. Maybe their spouse is in the office. Maybe their spouse is home. What was sort of, when you boiled all down, the common element there?
I would say that the people who are struggling the most with burnout right now are people who are working these flexible sorts of jobs where they have much more control over how much time that they're spending in the home, and their partner, especially in heterosexual marriages, doesn't have as much flex or is not taking as much flex. And so what they're doing is they're essentially working this full-time job for pay that they've been working for a long time, but then they're also taking on even more of that unpaid labor in the home. And a lot of that includes what's often called like the mental load, right? So like keeping the list in their head of all of the different things that have to be happening right now. And so they are working all the time on their salary job and then also taking up a lot more of that other unpaid labor. And that includes even things like, oh, they don't have enough bus drivers for the school district. So I guess that I will pick up my kid every day after school instead of them taking the bus home. Or something like, oh, my kid's sick and has to stay home. It used to be that my husband and I would rotate who would stay home with him. But since I'm already in the home, I guess I'll just stay here and my work will be affected. And then I'll need to stay up late to put in that work that I missed.
So basically, it's like what's going on in relationships. So here we are, we've gone through the pandemic, working from home. Women are like, wow, this could be really cool. Great, give me some flexibility, but still pursue my career and continue to move ahead. What's happening is what's happening internally within relationships, where the husband or the partner, I guess, has gone, the male partner, predominantly maybe in some cases, has gone back to work. And so when stuff happens at home, the woman is continuing to work from home, but also adding on everything else. I love, there's a picture in the story I'm looking at that I looked at the terminal of like the 1950s wife sending her kids off to school, you know, but, and she's kind of getting stuck.
Well, and I will say that this is also true, and I heard a lot of feedback after the piece was published. Even if you, the woman in these heterosexual relationships, if they are making more money, right, if their job is ostensibly within the paradigm of the relationship, the more important one, if they have flex, they are still the one who's taking up all of this extra labor. And I think it's really frustrating, right, because, like, what is the solution? And something I asked some people, I'm like, is there anything that your company could do to make a better policy for you? And, you know, everyone has small complaints about how their companies have orchestrated flexible work policies. Like, there are things that absolutely need to get better. But to the person, every single person told me that, like, no, this is a societal thing and it's also a relationship thing. And it's really hard to fix.
Right. Well, that's sort of getting to what I wanted to touch on, which is where does this go from here? To because back to the question you posed at the beginning, you know, if I could tell you, you wouldn't have to go into the office, put on work clothes, you could be at home in these flexible work arrangements. My gut feeling is that a lot of people, even with this burnout, this sort of one woman safety net that you've described, it doesn't feel like going into the office would fix that.
No, well, I think in some ways it would, because it would force you to find backup care, right? It would force you to figure out what were people doing before, right? We had emergency plans for like, oh, if the kid gets sick, we rotate turns off, and because we both conceive of our job as equal, right? That we would, one person goes and gets that person, or like school districts had more bus drivers and really made that a priority. And so I think that there are different ways that you can solve this problem. But we're just like, instead, it's been normalized that women are taking on more and more of this work. And if you look at things like the Deloitte study of women in work, that the numbers of burnout amongst women and mothers in particular in office jobs is just skyrocketing. And something has to give. And in a lot of cases, I think you have women who are like, I can't do it anymore. Like, the only way to make our family work now is for me not to work at all, for me to drop out of the workforce. And that's a different problem altogether.
Well, and it's interesting, right, Katie, in terms of we've got this very tight labor market. Mm. We talk about, you know, people who are just not coming back to the workforce, and you wonder how many, although we've seen some stronger numbers in terms of women, but you do wonder how this impacts it going forward. And a really, as Katie said, well and beautifully reported story. Really appreciate getting some time to talk with you. Ann Peterson, contributor at Bloomberg Business Week, on the phone from Lummi Island, Washington. And this story you can find on the Bloomberg terminal at bloomberg.com/businessweek. It's just all these things from the pandemic maybe not playing out as we anticipated initially.
I know. At least in this point, this piece points out, at least kids are back in school for the large part, not doing virtual school anymore.
So maybe one thing that they can cross off their list.
Right, yeah.
Be sure to check it out and more, all from Bloomberg Business Week. You can find that on the terminal.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic. on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, as we mentioned, we did want to get to the Bloomberg Big Take. It's also among the most read on the Bloomberg today. Bloomberg Big Take, by the way, is our editorial team saying, folks, you got to read this story. And it's a Bloomberg exclusive. And it is about the big bank, probably the most associated, Katie, with the U.S. mortgage industry.
Big time. Of course, we're talking about Wells Fargo. Great scoop from our Hannah Levitt that Wells Fargo plans to shrink the biggest U.S. mortgage empire, of course, after waves of scandals. Hannah, you join us on the phone now. Basically, walk us through the premise of this big take and how we got here.
Hey, yeah, thank you so much for having me. So, as you mentioned, like when you think Wells Fargo, you think the biggest U.S. home lender. Like, that was their whole thing for a number of years, right? Coming out of the financial crisis in 2008, a lot of the big banks who had dominated the space prior to the crisis pulled back in a big way. And Wells Fargo took the opposite approach and said, no, we're going to really dig in. You know, at one point, they were turning out one in every three home loans in the U.S., and they were aiming for higher than that. They were aiming for 40% market share. So that was then. And then, you know, since then, we've seen the rise of non-bank mortgage lenders like Quicken and stuff like that. And also Wells Fargo has had a lot of issues, some of which have been in its mortgage empire. And so now under Charlie Scharf, who has been the CEO for almost 3 years, they are making plans to shrink in mortgage.
How important is the mortgage business, though, to Wells Fargo's top and bottom line?
You know, that's a great question because it's less important today than it used to be. So the history going back before even the 2008 crisis was that they liked mortgage as a way to counterbalance, lower net interest income from lower interest rates. And so they would get fees from lower rates when people wanted to refinance the mortgage and such. And so it would be a counterweight to that. But the company has gotten a lot bigger. So it has become less relevant. And also it's a more competitive landscape today than it was, you know, when Wells was doing one in every three home loans in the U.S.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask, because that's such a crazy stat. One of every three home loans in the U.S. With Wells Fargo kind of planning to step away here, where does that leave the U.S. mortgage market?
Yeah, well, and so they certainly aren't doing one in three today. And it'll be really interesting to see, you know, they're still in the process of making plans of where they're going to pull back. You know, I wrote about their correspondent lending, which is when they fund mortgages that are made by other firms, and then servicing, so like billing and collections for mortgages as places where they're looking at. But, you know, a lot of that is still being sketched out, but it will be really interesting to see, you know, when all is said and done, where Wells Fargo fits into the greater mortgage picture.
Hey, Hannah, how much of this is just Wells Fargo saying, I am tired of being criticized for, you know, rejecting refinancing for black homeowners, for doing other things and being fine. I'm just tired of this. And if I get rid of this business, I'm no longer on regulators' radar.
Yeah, that's also a super interesting question, because a lot of the big banks, like, you know, Bank of America did, I want to say, over $100 billion of originations in a single quarter right after the crisis. And they were down to less than a tenth of that by 2018. So a lot of these banks already kind of concluded that. Remember, there were like tens of billions of dollars in fines. I think it actually might have gone over $100 billion total for the bank's behavior leading up to the crisis, causing the crisis in some ways. So Wells here is kind of, you know, in some sense, it's the last big bank to come to this conclusion. But also in recent years, you know, they have been very scandal ridden. That's why Charlie Scharf took over 3 years ago. And the mortgage business has been a key, you know, trouble spot for them.
And Hannah, we have about 40 seconds left, but you write that shrinking, even in a downturn, will be complicated. Tell us about some of those hurdles.
Yeah, so when the economy is worse, the value of the loans that they hold will go down. So that just makes it harder to, you know, for them to potentially sell this off or do whatever they're going to do, you know, versus when it's a great market and everyone is clamoring to get those assets and things like that.
It is a great story. It does also make me think about, you know, Hannah talked about more competition today in the mortgage business and all these upstarts, right, that have given homeowners or prospective homeowners so many different options,
yeah,
right, when it comes to either mortgages or home equity. It is the Bloomberg Big Take. It's among the most read on the Bloomberg today, and it's all about Wells Fargo shrinking the biggest U.S. mortgage empire after a bunch of scandals over the last few years. Hannah Levitt, she is finance reporter at Bloomberg News. Check her out on Twitter at Hannah Levitt, and she, of course, joining us on the phone.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
New York City.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right. So, dear Bob, I like your company. Think, though, we could make a few changes. Sincerely yours, Dan Loeb. Okay. That's not exactly what he wrote.
Pretty close, though.
You think so?
Yeah, kind of
close.
Know. Right? You got the main points.
Well, Dan Loeb did write a letter to Disney CEO Bob Chapek after taking a significant stake in the company and suggesting some changes at the Magic Kingdom.
Indeed. Again, this news breaking this morning definitely took a lot of people by surprise, just judging at the readership numbers on the Bloomberg terminal. For more, let's bring in Geeta Ranganathan. She, of course, is a Bloomberg intelligence analyst. And Geeta, this calling for a spinoff of the ESPN Sports Network, have to assume that Chapek and Co. haven't done this for a reason.
Yes. So this is something that has come up so many times, Katie and Carol, over the past few years. I mean, constant questions about whether it makes sense for ESPN to be spun off, just kind of given the secular challenges in the linear TV business model. The reason they're not doing it, and that reason is cash flow. Tons and tons of cash flow from ESPN, almost $4.5 billion every year. And remember, this is almost 30% of Disney's profits. So it is a crucial part of their business and one that they're not going to be willing to let go of very easily.
Well, Geeta, would this be like an activist investor saying, hey, Apple, we'd really love it if you'd spin off the iPhone in terms of sales? I mean, this is just so important to Disney, as you said.
Absolutely. It is a critical part of the business. Yes, agreed. There are lots of challenges in the business model, especially given that cord cutting is accelerating. But the whole streaming part of the business, yes, they are having pretty good growth there for streaming. They reported some fantastic numbers just a few days ago. They have more than, if you just look at their streaming portfolio now, they actually have more subscribers than Netflix has. But remember, streaming is not generating any profits for this company just yet. So getting that cash flow, getting those $4.5 billion from ESPN year in and year out is so important to fund all of that content investments in the streaming platform, all the technological improvements. So absolutely.
I have to say, it's a
core part of the business.
I have trouble with the timing on this, Katie. Mm-hmm. Like, wait, Disney did really well. What's up with this, Dan?
Yeah. Again, I guess if they had really woofed it in earnings, this would make a little bit more sense. But it does feel a bit unintuitive. Let's talk about some of the other suggestions here. We have Third Point also urging Disney to integrate Hulu directly into the Disney Plus platform. Of course, that's the company's flagship streaming operation. The logic there on the Third Point side is that this would save money, reignite growth in domestic streaming. Does that logic hold water with you?
I think it does to a certain extent. And again, this has, again, been one of those constant conundrums for Disney. Remember, Disney has a 66% stake in Hulu. This is jointly owned with Comcast. And the two companies actually have an agreement between them, which allows for Disney to buy back the 33% in January of 2024. The problem really here is valuation. So they have agreed to a minimum valuation of about $27 billion, which means Disney has to shell out at least $9 billion. But Comcast is going to want much, much more. And the two parties have been in arbitration. But again, this price is going to be a major sticking point, which is why Disney does not want to rush into it, is what I'm thinking.
Do you think on the cost-cutting side of things, you look at all the metrics when it comes to the Walt Disney Company, Geeta, when, Dan Loeb says cost-cutting, Disney costs are among the highest in the industry. We believe Disney significantly under-earns relative to its potential. We urge the company to embark on a cost-cutting program that addresses both margins and the disposal of excess underperforming assets. Is he right in that regard? And I am reading from his letter.
So he is right when he says that they have the highest costs in the industry. So remember, this year, Disney is going to pay out $30 billion in terms of content costs across its platforms. Now, that is the highest, by the way, in the industry. But the reason it's paying that much is because of majority of it is really because of sports rights. Mm. So, they're paying about $8 to $9 billion in sports rights. And that's why ESPN is the number one cable network when it comes to earning affiliate fees in the industry. That's what drives the $4.5 billion in EBITDA. Also, remember, this is the biggest movie studio in the world. They are half of the global box office. So in order to generate, 10, $11 billion in global box office, they have to make significant investments. Again, a major part of the cost there. You know, my only contention with the cost argument is you want to build a streaming platform that is, the leader, and you have to be careful because, content is the key differentiator.
Yeah, right. We say content is king. When you've got somebody like Thor, Love and Thunder, like, I'm in. I'm just going to tell you, I'm all in on Avengers.
Yeah, I don't watch movies.
He's looking at me.
Sounds great.
Always great is Geeta Ranganathan. She's Bloomberg Intelligence Technology and Media Analyst joining us on the phone in New Jersey. Geeta, thank you.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 10 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. And as you know, we've been talking, we've got another rally underway, slight rally, up about 19 on the S&P, as Charlie mentioned, up about 0.5% on the Dow, and the NASDAQ up by about 0.2%. So let's get to it as we drive to the close on this Monday. Hick Smith is back with us. He's Chief Investment Officer at Haverford Trust, which, as you know, is based in Radnor, Pennsylvania. Hank, nice to have you here with Katie Greifeld and myself. You have repeatedly come on with us this year, said a recession and a bear market are not likely. Is that still the case in your view?
Well, look, in one aspect, we do have a technical recession defined by two consecutive quarters with negative real GDP growth. But if we're in a recession, it's the most unusual recession in modern history, given the strength of the labor market, the health of the consumer, corporate profits, corporate balance sheets, the banking system is well capitalized, and there doesn't seem to be any problems there. So on the one hand, a lot looks good about the economy. The big part, though, is inflation.
A lot looks good in the economy, inflation being its own special animal. What does the stock market look like, though? Because if we think about the past 2 months since June's lows, it's been a pretty robust rally. The question it feels like everyone is asking is whether that June low was actually the bottom. What's your view?
Well, look, the stock market is an anticipatory vehicle. It anticipated peak inflation, which is really kind of June-ish, with a very weak first half. And now I think it's anticipating that we are beyond peak inflation, and that a lot of factors, including the Federal Reserve's policy, is starting to unwind inflation. And perhaps the Fed might get lucky and engineer a somewhat soft landing. And so I think that's what the market is really focusing on. I don't think they're focusing on a Fed pivot, because I think we're going to see Fed fund rate increases through 2022. But maybe that's it. Maybe in 23, we're done that.
Hank, we'd love to talk macro issues with you. I put out my Twitter poll this morning and I said, new week, what's top of mind for everybody? And so far, the votes are coming in. 32% say a China-U.S. slowdown, or the China-U.S. slowdowns that we're already seeing. Almost 30% say the retail earnings we're going to get this week and also the retail sales data on Wednesday. 24% say the FOMC minutes, which we also get on Wednesday from that last Fed meeting. And about 13.5% say other, which they are weighing in on different things that are top of mind for them. What's top of mind for you when you think about this week ahead?
Well, I think the retail earnings are very important, although clearly there's been a shift in spending from goods to services and experiences. Because if you look at what MasterCard and Visa have been saying, that spending is still pretty robust, but it's in different areas. But I still think it's important what we see from Walmart, Target, Home Depot, Lowe's, because that's a good measure of the strength of the consumer. So that's top on mind this week. And yes, geopolitical events. I think the market has gotten, I hate to say it this way, almost used to the conflict in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And there's potential that, you know, that could get worse given the fall and early winter approaching in a handful of months in terms of oil and natural gas throughout Europe.
And so how do you sort of structure your portfolio with some of those geopolitical concerns in mind, particularly when it comes to the energy sector? For example, if I look at the S&P 500 at the sector level, that's by far the winner. Do you think that trade has sort of run its course at this point?
Yeah, we are very, very light in the energy sector, so we missed much of the move in the second half of 21 and into 22, except for some of our yield-oriented strategies where we do have some energy exposure because of the very high yields in names like Chevron. But, you know, the... We're continuing to stay away from the sector due to the cyclicality of it and the lower quality. I mean, when you look at how many companies in the energy patch went out of business in 2020 when you had the complete collapse in the oil prices. It's a tough sector to invest in. In terms of where we're focusing on, our biggest weight is in the healthcare industry sector, and there I think there's three things going on. The reopening play, people are finally getting procedures that have been delayed because of the pandemic. Also, it's a defensive sector, and it's a attractively priced sector, and you get good yields with growth of income, and that's a nice combination in an inflationary environment.
Where don't you want to be right now?
Well, you know, I did mention energy, which mm-hmm. you know, we don't in our growth strategies. We don't have any waiting there, and we're absent utilities and REITs. Those are the three areas where we have no exposure.
All right, and so.
And I'd also say we continue to favor equities over fixed income.
Well, that's where I wanted to go, actually. I'm glad you brought that up. Talk to me a little bit about that, because if I look at the Treasury market, for example, we've seen a big, big rally.
Yeah, and clearly yields are higher today, even with the rally in prices recently. Yields are higher today than they were a year ago, for sure. But if you have an outlook of 5, 7, 10 years, you're hard-pressed to make a case that you're going to get a better rate of return in fixed income, whether it's corporates or treasuries, than you are in owning equities, and particularly dividend-paying and dividend-growing equities. And so I think you'd have to see yields much higher before they're a competition for equities.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Hey, Hank, good to check in with you again. Hank Smith, Chief Investment Officer at Haverford Trust, that company based in Radnor, Pennsylvania.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it. If you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company, Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.